Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is Perek Chaf Hei, the final Perek of the Book of Melachim. It is sadly a Perek that deals with Churban, with destruction, in so many ways, and is unfortunately, or sadly, a fitting end to the book, as the book has sort of been a downward spiral, not spiral, a downward graph towards destruction, meaning there have been bumps upwards. If you think of a failing corporation and you think about corporate earnings that are relentlessly moving downwards, but they have spikes upwards, so that's sort of the graph of the Book of Melachim as well. We've had kings who have bucked the trend, but pretty much from the time of Shlomo HaMelech, we've been going in a wrong direction, and so now is when the culmination of all of that is going to come true. So in Perek Chaf Hei, Pasuk Aleph, Vayi, Bishnata Tishiit Lemolcho, in the ninth year of Tzidkiyahu's reign, Bechodesh HaAsiri BeAsor LaChodesh, in the tenth month, in the tenth day, Vanevuchanetzer Melech Bavel Hu V'Chol Chelo Yerushalayim Vayichan Aleha, they come and they set siege, Vayivnu Aleha Dayek Saviv, and they build ramparts around, they build a siege tower around it, meaning they're building a thing to make sure that nobody is coming in or out, so that the city can be held up and can be starved out until they come out. I just point out that Chodesh HaYisiri B'Asar LaChodesh would seem to be the 10th of Tevet, which is in fact when we mourn the beginning of the siege, because we see the beginning of the siege, even though it happens in the 9th year, and the destruction won't happen until later, the 11th or the 12th year, depending on how you read the Pesukim, but nonetheless, this is the beginning of the end. And part of what is part of the flaw of the Book of Melachim, of the Jewish people in the Book of Melachim, has always been their inability to see the future consequences of the current events, of the current occurrences. So it's the not seeing this as so dramatically problematic that they need to immediately do whatever they can to avoid the consequences that are clearly on their way to coming. That's part of the tragedy of the Churban as well, the blindness of the people. Pasuk Bet Vatavoha Ir Bamator, there's a siege Ad Ashtei Esrei Shana until the 11th year, LaMelech Tzidkiyahu B'Tisha Al HaChodesh, on the 9th of the month, VaYechazak Ra'av Ba'ir, the famine was excessive in the city, Lo Ya Lechem Lamar, so there was no food, VaTibaka Ha'ir, and so the city was breached, meaning the walls were breached, V'Chon Shem Milchama Halayla Derech Shar Bein HaChomatayim Asher Al Gan HaMelech. So it's a hard pasuk in terms of taking it literally, that the soldiers ran away and there was a gate ben achomatayim between the walls near the king's garden, and the kazdim who were watching the city, they chased them all the way into the plains. They chased the king and they find him in the plains of Yericho, and all of his soldiers scattered from upon him, and this is how Tzidkiyahu gets caught. Pasuk Vav is Vayipesu et Hamelech Vayalu Oto El Melech Bavel Rivlata Vayidabu Eto El Mishpat. They take him to Nebuchadnezzar, who's in Rivla. We'll get there in a second, and he rebukes him for having rebelled against him. A couple of points here that need to be mentioned. So first, this whole fleeing thing. The Rashi quotes the tradition that says that Tzidkiyahu had a cave, and he had a hidden cave, and that this hidden cave was an escape route, and the cave went all the way to Yericho, and so Tzidkiyahu thought he could escape that way. And then the tradition is that Hashem had led a deer to run right in front of the Kazdi soldiers, the Babylonian, the Chaldean soldiers, on the cave, on the roof of the cave, so they were chasing the deer, having no idea that Tzidkiyahu was fleeing, because it's a secret cave, and the war is going on in the city, so you couldn't verify the king was gone for a long time. But as he's running away, they chased him, and when the deer jumps out at the very edge of the cave, it's as Tzidkiyahu is coming out at the edge of the cave, and they therefore catch Tzidkiyahu, and they bring him to Nebuchadnezzar to be rebuked. So there's an interesting Gemara in Sota, where the Gemara says, there were five people who were given a piece of, in some way, something reflecting Hashem in their physical attributes. And Rashi says, all that means is, they're different than other human beings because they're so wondrous and so beautiful. So they give examples of Shimshon with his strength and Shaul with his neck, and the reason why it's his neck is because the pasuk says, "Mishichmo v'mala," he was vaybakol ha'am mishichmo. From his shoulders and up, he was higher than everybody else. So you think that just means taller, and I would generally think, as soon as he was taller than everybody, he was a head, as we would say today, he was a head and neck taller. So Rashi thinks the Gemara is saying that in this case, not only that, but that something about his neck really reflected an otherworldly wondrousness. And then it mentions Avshalom with his hair, and that we know because he gets caught up in his hair in the tree when he gets killed. And then it says, Tikyo ben Einav is what the Gemara says. Tikyo with his eyes. Dichtiv, as it says, now the Dichtiv is the end of that Gemara. The Gemara's point was, there were five who were created with these special attributes, and then each one of them ends up being punished or damaged by them. So Shimshon, his strength is what is his downfall. Shaul, with the neck, so the interesting thing, the Gemara says that at the end of Shaul's life, the pasuk says that he fell on his sword. So I, when I visualized it, always thought he fell on his sword on his stomach, but the Gemara seems to be assuming that he fell on a sword on his neck, which is the place where you kill people, and etc. So it's Yo, you see, we're going to see in a minute that in Pasuk Zion, I'll read it now, but they kill his sons in front of him, and they blind him, and they put him in chains, and they bring him to Babel. So I remember reading a medrash that's built off of this Gemara that said that that there's a connection actually between the killing of his sons and his blinding. That in fact, if his eyes are a reflection of Hashem, they're so wondrous, perhaps they were so strong that they couldn't figure out a way to blind them. But that when they killed the sons in front of him, his crying blinded him. He literally cried his eyes out. So that's a medrash that says that. So here the Gemara only says how it knows that that was what he was locating. So unless you want to say the Gemara is reasoning circularly, from the fact that you see that he got punished through that, it must mean he had a great one. For that circular reason, because the whole point of the Gemara was to say that they had this great thing, and then they were punished through that great thing. And the same thing with Asa. So Rashi says, I don't know where they got that these were so great, his eyes. Lo yudana minalan dinishtana lishvach. And so too with Asa and his legs. So the Maharsha there, and the Gemara says, Rashi says he doesn't know, but I think it might be this incident with the cave. If you have a cave that extends from Yerushalayim all the way to the plains of Yericho, that's going to be an extremely long cave. So we would assume that they took some kind of light source with them. But the Rashi says, maybe the Gemara wasn't assuming that. Maybe the Gemara was assuming that Tzidkiyahu just led his men, and it's extremely dark. So that shows you that his eyes were remarkably powerful, and maybe that's where the Gemara got it from. So that's one issue. Another issue is that the king of Babel seems to be in Rivla, instead of being where we would have thought he was, which is the Yerushalayim at the siege. So the Mefarshim, including the Radak, says, no, that he had been in Rivla, but the siege took so long that he had other business to take care of, so he left his servants to pursue the siege, but he wasn't actually there when the city was conquered. So, another issue to consider and to think about. And then, Vayidabru ito mishpat, he rebukes him. Right? They chastise Tzidkiyahu when they get there. So, it's possible that this chastising is just sort of stereotypical. When you see a guy who was betrayed, you just yell at him. But it almost has the sense to it that the politics of the time had a certain amount of trust to it, and there was an expectation that if I put you on the throne and if I take tribute from you, you've made a commitment to follow me and to serve me and to pay tribute to me. And when you rebel against me and make me come and fight with you, there's a moral flaw there. Right? But has the element of that Nebuchadnezzar experiences this as a moral failing of Tzidkiyahu's, that he was moreh, that he was rebelling. So, and I think that's an interesting perspective on what's going on here. So that's the end of Tzidkiyahu's reign. So Pasuk Ched v'chodesh hamishi b'shiva l'chodesh. This is getting into Tisha B'Av. So the question is, what happens with Zion? So Chazal say, yeah, it was the seventh, and then on the seventh they come to the Beis Hamikdash, and the eighth and the ninth they just fool around there. They do all sorts of terrible things there, but they don't actually destroy it. And then on the ninth it got destroyed. So v'chodesh b'shiva l'chodesh hishnat chasvei shana l'melech Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar banu v'zardan rav tabachim v'ev melech Bavel Yerushalayim. His chief executioner, Nebuzaradan, comes to Yerushalayim, v'yisrof et beit Hashem v'beit HaMelech, and he burns the Beit HaMikdash and the king's house, v'eit kol batei Yerushalayim et kol bayit beit gadol zaraf ba'esh, and he burns all the houses of Yerushalayim, and then beit gadol, Chazal understood to mean the batei medrash, the place where you would learn Torah, and it's gadol because it lifts people up, which is obviously a theme that Chazal would be interested in pursuing. I would also note right here that this is going to be one of the last times, and therefore perhaps I should have noted it before, but we've seen it also with monies. Whenever we have people paying tribute or taking money to buy off somebody, they take the Otzrot Beit Hashem and the Otzrot Beit HaMelech. Right? And it's almost as if, or it's suggested as if, and I think about this because we noted that Yoshiyahu pursues a war with Paro, and that's what gets him killed. And I didn't mention it there, but it's worth mentioning that he doesn't seem to consult with the Navi about that. He consults with the Navi when he's in, when he hears the Sefer Torah being read, and he doesn't know what it means, and he's all upset about it. Then he consults with Chulda the Nevi'ah. But you'll notice the almost complete absence of Yirmiyahu from this Sefer, or perhaps the complete absence of Yirmiyahu from this Sefer. We mentioned that Yishayo wasn't all that present, and there's mention of Nevi'im, but not of anything to do with them. Well, I wonder whether that might not imply that the kings weren't consulting with the Nevi'im nearly enough. The reason I would think about this is that it might fit in with the theme of the kings being too taken with their own power that we've seen several times. So we've seen kings who think that they have the right to serve in the Beit HaMikdash. We've seen kings who pursue wars when they're not supposed to, who rebel against kings when they're not supposed to. So the kings pursue wars on their own, and they make decisions about these issues, and they take it upon themselves to, and Chizkiyah, we saw, was all excited about his having treasures, and he shows it to the king of Babel, and that's taken as being a problem. There seems to be this continuing challenge, even for the best of the Malchi Yehuda, of not knowing exactly how to incorporate the Navi and the Nevuot into their rule. And I wonder whether this juxtaposition might not suggest some of that as well, that there were two vital places within the city of Yerushalayim. There was Beit Hashem, and there was Beit HaMelech. And they were sort of separate and independent, and if they had been more intertwined or more knew how to work with each other, maybe that's an example of an issue that had not been resolved during time of Bayit Rishon. Pasuk Yud, Ve'eit chomat Yerushalayim saviv natitzu kol chel kasdim asher rav tabachim. And the walls of the city all around, so the Kasdi armies destroyed the walls of Yerushalayim, the ones who were with Nebuzaradan. So the rest of the people, meaning not the Chavash and the Mazger, the remainders who had been left in the city and who were in the suburbs of the city and who had surrendered to the king of Bavel earlier before that, so all of them were exiled. So he's taken away the backbone of the city. But he left the very poor. So you got to imagine, this very poor is really very poor because he's already taken out the nobility and the upper classes in a previous exile. That's what Nebuchadnezzar had done. So now he's taking out the next levels of the classes and he's leaving behind workers and vineyards in the fields. So Pasuk Yud Gimel, Ve'amudei HaChodesh HaNechoshet Shel Beit Hashem VeMechonot VeYam HaNechoshet Shel Beit Hashem Shibru Chasdim VeYisu Et Nechushtam Bavela. So they took all of the copper pillars, all the things that Yishlomo HaMelech had built and built along the ways, all of the vessels and all of the furniture. So there were the copper pillars that were in the Beit Hashem, there were the mechonot, the stands for the kiyorot, for the things that would hold the water, and the Yam HaNechoshet that there had been, where it was just a decorative kind of a thing, and they broke it, and they took the copper to Bavel. Pasuk Yud Dalet, Ve'asirot, Ve'ayim, Ve'amizamirot, Ve'akapot, Ve'kol Klei HaNechoshet, She'yashertu V'am, Lakachu, and all the pots, and the shovels, and musical instruments, all the things that were in the Beit HaMikdash, they took with them. Ve'amachtot, Ve'mizrakot, Asher Zahav, Zahav, Asher Kesef, Kasev, Lakach, Rav, Atabachim. And some of them were gold, and some of them were silver, and these were the machtot were pans to put incense in, and mizrakot were bowls, either for dam to stir blood in, or to throw the blood from the bowl sometimes. Sometimes put your hand in the bowl and you sprinkled all those things. Some of them were gold, some of them were silver. All of that is taken. Hamudim shnayim hayam echad v'mechonot, asher asa shlomo levet Hashem, lo hayam mishkal l'nechoshet kol hakelim ha'ele. And there were two pillars, one yam and a bunch of stands for the washing stations, what we would call them today, Shlomo HaMelech had made, and there was no way to measure the weight of all of this precious metal that was now being taken to Bavel. Pasuk Yud Zayin, Shmona Esrei Amma Komat Amud Echad, one of these stands was 18 Amma high, so that gives you a sense of how much copper there was in it. V'choter Alav Nechoshet, and had a copper copper crown of sorts, a top on the thing. The Komanakoteret Shloshamah, that was another 3 amot. Usvacha v'rimonim, Malakoteret, there was a netting, and there were pomegranates on this top part, Saviv, around it, meaning a decorative on top of the, as the head of the column. There's probably some name for it in architecture when you have the decorative top of the column. If you want to email me that, I would love to know. My email, again, for those of you who have not been using it, is grothst@gmail.com, and you can email me and tell me what it's called when you have a decorative column, the top of it is called or something. So that was also all Nechoshet. And the same thing with the second pillar on the netting. Pasuk Yudchet, Vayikach Rav Tabachim et Tzraya Kohen Arosh, Vet Tzfanya Kohen Mishneh, Vet Shloshet Tzumri Hasaf. So the Nevuzaradan now takes the head Kohen, Tzraya, and the second Kohen, the Sgan Kohen, and three Kohanim who were in charge of overseeing the kelim, the vessels, the tools, the appurtenances of the Beit HaMikdash. Umin ha'ir, lakach saris echad ashehu pakid al anshei ha-milchama, he took one guy who was in charge of the, ashehu pakid al anshei ha-milchama, Rashi says, he was in charge of keeping count of the warriors of the army. So there was a guy whose job it was to keep track of the numbers in the army. So he takes him too. Pakid is commanded over. And five people who saw the king, meaning were close advisors of the king, were found in the city. Veda Sofer Tzarezavah. I'm sorry, that's the guy who would count. His job was to count to make sure they knew how many soldiers they had. Vishishim Ishmi Amaret. And 60 people, just from the regular people, Nimtzeim Ba'ir, that were found in the city. Pasukhav, Vaikach, Otam, Nevuzaradan, Rav Tabachim, Vayelachotam, Amelach, Bavel, Rivlat. And he takes them to Rivla, where the king is. So the king kills them. And then the Jewish people, basically Yehuda, the southern kingdom, is now being exiled from upon its land. And those who know a little bit of the book of Ezra will know that when the time comes to go back, it's not going to be so many people who go back. So this is really pretty much the last time that the majority of the Jewish people have lived in Eretz Yisrael. Since we still don't have that yet, we are on the verge of it, and I like to point that out because there are several halachot, there are numerous halachot that come into play once the majority of the Jewish people are living in Eretz Israel, and we are closing in on that vital and important statistic, but we're not there yet. So this is the last point where that might still have been true in Jewish history, that the majority of the Jewish people lived in Yehuda, and various issues would be a doraita halacha, a doraita requirement, as opposed to today when so many of the issues tied up in Eretz Israel are derabanan requirements. I also would point out that we base our tradition of reading the Torah with three people, or five people, or seven people. So the Gemara Megillah suggests that some of that comes from here, when there's a reference to Chamisha Ro'i Pnei HaMelech, or Shiva Anashim, and that those are the parallel, or the precursor, for how we chose the numbers of people, of Aliyot to give. So according to that Gemara Megillah, what it's suggesting is that what you see, the structure of how the kings of Yehuda had structured their advisors and structure their the presence of advisors around them, maybe is how we think that Torah should be structured as well. So that's an idea that is worth remembering, I guess, when you watch the Aliyot, to know that what we're sort of saying is that we are structuring our presence before Hashem in terms of reading the Torah, and we're doing it based on what we saw was the practice and the tradition among Malchei Yehuda. So the Pasuk Chav Bet. Remember, he had left the Dalat Haaretz, the very poorest of the land, and they were left just to work the field a little bit. And he leaves as a ruler over them Gedaliah, who we all know because of some Gedaliah, taking away some of the suspense of this story, for those who have never read Malachim before, because we sort of know the end of the story. Although that doesn't stop us from necessarily being upset by it. I've always been struck, and I've told this to my family many times, I've always been struck by how at Shiva visit, sometimes they'll tell you the story of the last days of the person's life, whoever it may have been, and along the way there may have been some situation, some occurrence where the person had some setback in health. And I've always watched, or been interested to watch, people at the Shiva visit will go, oi, oi, you know, and I'm sitting at a Shiva call, which means that I know the end of the story, and I know that it turned out even less good than, you know, when he took a turn for the worse, he ran a fever that night. And so I've always been struck by that. So here too, we may know the end of the story, and yet it doesn't stop us from from tisking and from being upset as we watch it unfold. So people around, whoever's left, who might have some kind of military capability, some kind of power, hears that the king of Bavel has made Gedaliah in charge. So they come to Mitzpah to meet up with Gedaliah. So Mitzpah is a long-standing, back from the book of Shmuel, is a long-standing place of national gatherings. Vishmael ben Netanya. So these are names worth paying attention to. Vishmael ben Netanya, Vyochanan ben Kareach, Usraya ben Tanchumet, and Netofati, Vyazanyahu ben Hamachati, Haimavan Shem. So these four leaders and their men, almost as if they were roving bands of people who had escaped or not been caught by Nebuchadnezzar. So even though Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuchadnezzar had exiled the vast majority of the upper class, these were a few people with a few bands of people still left. So they come to see Gedaliah. They swears to them. We can make this work. We can make this go, and you don't have to be afraid of the Kazdim. Shivuva aretz. If you do it, Melech Bavel, v'itav lachem. Stay in the land and serve the king of Bavel, and it will be good for you. Now I mentioned that we don't refer to Yirmiyahu a lot in the book of Malachim itself. One of the themes of Yirmiyahu was to recognize that the king of Bavel coming was sort of punishment from Hashem for various sins that we had committed, and therefore urging the people to surrender to the king of Bavel before the war reached its final stage. And of course, Yirmiyahu is ignored. So here too, Gedaliah was left by the king of Bavel, and he's going to make the same or very similar advice. He's going to give the same advice. And let's just serve the king of Bavel. Pasuk Chav Hei, Vahi B'chodesh HaShavi'i, which is Tishrei, obviously. Ba'ishma ben Netanya ben Elishama Mizer HaMelucha. He was of the royal family. That's important because it explains sort of what he's doing. Ba'asara Nishim Yito, he got 10 men with him. Ve'akui Gedaliah Vayamot, they kill Gedaliah. And the Jews and the Kazdim. In other words, he seemed to have had an outpost where he was cooperating with, and this is obviously what the problem is in the eyes of Ishmael, he's cooperating with the enemy. And so he has urged them to say, don't see them as the enemy, for all that they conquered us, for all that they, and it's not so simple, it's not like it's a simple idea that Gedaliah has. Gedaliah is urging them to understand that for all that these people came and destroyed our national sovereignty and destroyed our Beit HaMikdash, we have to learn to cooperate with them and get along with them. So obviously you can easily imagine people taking that as giving in too much and as turning traitor to your own people. And Yishmael is from the Melucha family. So we've seen before that the kings, one of their central flaws was their insistence on their ability to gain autonomy and to rule for themselves, even when it wasn't true. So they think they're going to be able to push the issue. So Pasuk Chav Vav, Vayakumu Chol Ha'am V'Katon V'Ad Gadol, So once this happens, the people no longer trust that they can make any kind of a pact with the Kazdim. They don't have any belief that they could say to the Kazdim, this wasn't us, and we denounce and we object to the action of Yishmael ben Netanya. They're sure that they're going to be punished for this. So that's another question always to wonder to yourself. When are the people implicated by somebody else's actions? We nowadays might tend to assume, or people around us might tend to assume, that you never implicate the people at all in the actions of others. So if that were true, then the fleeing that they do here is completely ridiculous, because they bear no responsibility for it. They assume very differently. They assume that they're going to be blamed for it, and that they can't even come along and say, we don't take part in this, we don't agree to this, we don't accept this, and have that count in any way to save them from the wrath of the Bavliim. So there might be a middle road. It might be that when somebody does something from your community, you have to see it as being something that is part of your community. But if you stand up and denounce it and say, I object to this, I don't see this as part of who I see myself as, who I think of myself as being, so then already it might be that you've cleansed yourself of it. That would be similar to the whole parsha of Egla Arufa, right? In Egla Arufa, the Gemara wonders at why we make the Zakenim go in and they say, our hands did not kill this person and we didn't see him. So the Gemara has an explanation, which it says that we didn't see him come and needing escort and not give him the escort that he needed. So it suggests that maybe there was some responsibility that the community could have had on its own. But it's also saying that the community recognizes that it bears responsibility even for crimes that occur in its midst that it didn't do, but it just didn't avoid enough. And therefore it says, we reject this and we denounce this. And that seems to be what the Torah says, that they can cleanse themselves of it. So here, those possibilities don't seem to occur to these people because they flee to Egypt. And we don't see it here, but in the book of Yirmiyahu, at the end of the book of Yirmiyahu, I'm hoping one day soon that a book of my stories will come out. And there's a story in there about that incident because it's an astounding incident. The people at the end of the book of Yirmiyahu come to Yirmiyahu and say, should we go to Mitzrayim? Should we stay here? And he gets a nevuah. It takes 10 days. Maybe that's a key issue. But he gets a nevuah in which Hashem says, stay here and you'll be okay. And they go to Mitzrayim anyway and they drag him with him. They drag him with them. So that might highlight another aspect of where the Jewish people had failed so thoroughly that they could not see where they were supposed to go because they can't understand that they might have to make peace with the Kazdim and they might have to have common purpose with those who have been enemies to them. They also can't understand that the fact that Yishmael ben Netanya does something doesn't have to implicate them fully and permanently. Pasuk Chav Zayin, Vayivish Loshim Vasheva Shana Legalut Yehoyachin Melech Yehuda, V'shneimasar Chodesh V'asrim V'shiva LaChodesh, in the 37th year of Yehoyachin having been exiled. And it's also true that in this exile, Chazal assume that Yechezkel, the prophet, was a part of that original group who had been exiled. I mention that for several reasons, among them being that, God willing, I will be also making these MP3 shiurim for the book of Yechezkel, so that is when this virtual relationship that we have, more one-sided. I'm hoping you will email me and tell me your thoughts and feelings and share ideas that you have at grothst@gmail.com, but so far it's sort of one-sided, that the book of Yechezkel will be the next place that we meet, and that's that group. So now that group who's still in Bavel and who Chazal said were sent there, at least partially, to lay the groundwork for the rest. So in the 27th day of the month, Besim Shiva Lachodesh, Nasa Evil Merodach Melech Bavel, the new king of Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar has passed away, has died, Bishnat Molcho, in the year that he becomes the king, he is Noseh Rosh Yoyachin Melech Yudah Beit Kela. He takes Yoyachin out of jail, Vaydeber Ito Tovot, and he speaks well with him, Vaytene Kiso Me'al Kiseh Melechim Asher Yitob Bavel, and he puts him above the other kings in Bavel. Vishinad Bigdei Chilo, and he takes away the prison clothing, Vachal Lechem Tamid Lifanav Kol Yimei Chayav, and he gives him a permanent meal. He gives him regular meals, meaning he supports him with regular kingly meals for the rest of his life. So, interestingly, it says here the 27th day of the month. So Chazal note that in Yirmiyahu it says the 25th day of the month, and therefore Chazal, Radak quotes it, Chazal say on the 25th Nebuchadnezzar died. On the 26th he was buried. On the 27th, Evil Merodach took Nebuchadnezzar out of the burial site and dragged his bones in public. So the question is why? Rashi doesn't quote the same measures as the Radak does. Rashi says it was to demonstrate that he was not going to follow the decrees of Nebuchadnezzar. That already casts a whole new light on many of the incidents that we've seen in Malachim, not many, but several times we had a son who dragged his father's bones through the streets of Yerushalayim. Part of the point of that then is not only to disgrace the father, but to declare his absolute rejection of the father's ways. So that might be what Evel Merodach is doing. Radak for himself mentions the tradition in Chazal. There's a tradition that Nebuchadnezzar went crazy at some point in his life and spent several years living among the animals. So he disappeared and lived among the animals. I think some versions of the measures have him even being turned into an animal, but certainly went to live among the animals. And during that time, two possibilities. Either another son became king, and when Nebuchadnezzar came back, he killed that son. Or Evil Merodach himself became king, Radak point suggests, and then Evil Merodach gets put in jail when his father comes back. So when Nebuchadnezzar really dies, and Evil Merodach is let out of jail, or Evil Merodach knows what happened to the previous brother, he's worried that it's not really Nebuchadnezzar dying. He's sort of got a skittish aspect to it, and therefore he drags the bones to make sure to prove to himself and to everybody else that Nebuchadnezzar is really, really dead. So those are interesting things, and they give an interesting perspective on what's going on with Yehoyachin. Since Nebuchadnezzar had put Yehoyachin in jail, so taking him out is Evil Merodach's way of again, separating the connection between him and his father. But it also fits in with two different themes in Chazal. One theme in Chazal is a Medrash Tanchuma that notes that any of the klalot, of the curses that David cursed Yoav, when David is upset with Yoav for killing Avshalom, he curses Yoav, and then there's a whole question whether he takes it back, but he says, V'al yachreit mi beit Yoav, zav, v'mitzor, machzik, b'pelach, menofel, b'cherem, v'chaser, lachem. And so the Medrash Tanchuma and the Gemara in Sanhedrin note that each of these curses happened to some descendant of David HaMelech. So Yehoyachin is the one who is a chaser lachem, who is lacking in bread because he spends time in jail and he has very little bread because he didn't used to feed. He didn't used to be prisoners' rights the way there is today, so he didn't feed prisoners so well. But then the Avos de Rabbi Nassan has another Mishnah that's talking about the fire of Al Tityesh Min HaPuranut. So usually Al Tityesh Min HaPuranut means, is taken to mean, don't ever think that punishment will never come. Don't give up on the possibility of punishment. Don't think that I sinned when I was 15, I never got punished for it, and I never did tshuva for it, but God seems to have forgotten about it. You should never think that. That's the general meaning. But another meaning, a more midrashic meaning, would be Al Tityesh Min HaPuranut. When you're being punished, you shouldn't despair either. This would be the flip side. One is, when life is going well and you think you've gotten away with things, don't think that's true, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu will always have the accounting come to play. Maybe not in this world, maybe in the next world, but it'll always be there. So you should never think that you've avoided punishment. But the other thing is always also true. You should never think, no matter how bad it's gotten, that it's never possibly going to get better. That doesn't mean it will get better, but you should never give up on the possibility. An example that they give is Yehoyachin, who was in jail for all this time. And then he gets taken out, and the rest of his life, Pasuk Lamed, Varuchato, Aruchat Tamid Nalo Me Tamelech Vayom Yomo Koyime Chayav. And he gets a meal, a good portion from the king, every day of his life for the rest of his life. And that's the end of the book of Melachim. And so I think that ending is interesting. That last little, those last four psukim, sort of, you might have ended with the Jews running to Mitzrayim. But if you'd ended with the Jews running to Mitzrayim, you would have ended on a note of complete and utter destruction. Right? The Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. First you had the nobility taken into exile, then you have the Beis HaMikdash destroyed, and the next level taken into exile, leaving the very poorest. They can't even make it work. Gedaliah gets killed. They flee to Egypt. Who knows who's left in Yehuda? And that's the end. It's a nevuah of Churban. By adding these four psukim, especially with that tradition of Avos de Rabbi Nassan, Avos de Rabbi Nassan is probably a brisa, so it's from a Tannaitic material. So it's the earliest of our oral traditions that we have still extant, is saying that the lesson might be, though, that even when everything looks so bad, we have to always know also that there is the possibility of HaKadosh Baruch Hu bringing us back. So just like Yehoyachin was taken into exile for a long period of time, it's not like he took it into exile and then he was fine. He was taken into exile. It was the 37th year of his exile. And then the kings switch, and Evil Merodach comes into power, and then the rest of his life is yachasit, is relatively easy. So thank God it's never enjoyable or pleasure or pleasant to have to teach about times of trouble and distress for our people. And we've learned many lessons that should give us pause as we learn these books together. And I hope you've enjoyed this process as much as I have. It's really been a productive and fulfilling and enjoyable experience for me to have the opportunity to share my thoughts with you. And I hope they've been productive for you as well. But it's also a Baruch Hashem kind of a situation, a thank God kind of a situation, that these last four psukim leave us with some hope as well. And I think that the end of the book is trying to say, for all that the story ends here at Churban Bayit Rishon, and with the group of people living in Eretz Yisrael, a very small group, because the central group of them, of the remnants who were left, have fled to Egypt, we're never supposed to think that that's the end of the story for the Jewish people. There never is an end to the story until HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring us back, and that is what Yehoyachin shows us. He goes into exile. He would think that it's an exile that would just be the story of his life, and yet at the end of his life, it turns a little bit better for him as well, and that is the hope we have to cling to as we go on in reading of Tanakh, and as we go on in experiencing Jewish history in the light of the lessons that Tanakh teaches us. This is one of the central lessons we should keep with us. There are flaws. There are problems. There's Puranut, but Al Tityesh Min HaPuranut, we should never give up, because we know that eventually it will, in the case of the nation, it doesn't have to be true for every individual, but certainly in the case of the nation, it will eventually turn around and we will have the kind of redemption for which we long so well. Thank you for your time. Thank you for joining me. And I hope you enjoy the books of Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu. I look forward to joining you again for the book of Yechezkel. Signing off from the book of Melachim, this is Gideon Rothstein. Thank you very much.